I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Jim, you mentioned the last week to me in an email that it appears that the empires are striking back. Could you explain to our audience what you meant by that?
Well, you know, one of the pieces that I'm working on for Strategy Page is tentatively titled The Empire Strike Back. And it comes from something, you know, Austin Bay and I have basically talked about in the past and books we've collaborated on, especially the Quick and Dirty Guide to War, is that empires are, you know, the idea of empire is persistent. You know, I described it as similar to syphilis or herpes. You know, it goes dormant, but eventually it comes back. Not the best results. One of the more recent examples we've seen was in the 1930s when all of a sudden, you know, Mussolini comes along and he's talking about Imperium Romanum, bringing back the old Roman Empire. Yeah, he had all the symbology, talking the talk, but, you know, it was gone. You know, there was no bringing it back. But the idea persists. And when you look at what is afflicting the world today in terms of, you know, disturbing the peace, most of it goes back to attempts to revive basically dead empires. For example, the four that I mentioned to Dan were the Russian Empire, which is fairly obvious right now because, you know, the Russians have been very loud about it, and they currently grabbed a piece of the Ukraine, and they're working on grabbing some more. You know, back in 2008, they grabbed a little chunk of about 5% of Georgia, which was, you know, a sort of an aperitif. You know, they said, hey, appetizer, this is going to get us started. What China is doing in the South China Sea, and has already done by grabbing Tibet in the 1950s, is they are trying to put back the old Chinese Empire. The Chinese Empire, the empire, formally ended in 1911 with one more revolution, but it had been falling apart for over a century. But probably the one that's most in our face, and we don't really see it, unless you're a Muslim, is the Caliphate. That is the ancient Islamic empire. For about three centuries, you know, from the 7th century to the 10th century, there was a caliphate. There was one leader of almost all, you know, Muslims. Now, Islam got started in the 7th century, and it took about three centuries before the nationalism, ethno, you know, centrism, whatever you want to call it, broke it apart, and nobody's been able to put it back together since. But it's remained a goal, especially for Islamic conservatives and Islamic radicals. And when you go into the fine print, as it were, of Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, all these, you know, Islamic, you know, revival organizations, they all eventually come to, we have to restore the caliphate. In other words, now it's pitched as a world government. So they not only want a leader for all of, you know, Islam, and the caliph was, in effect, a civil/religious leader. You know, sort of like the Pope with an army. And this, of course, is nothing unique in human history. You know, where for thousands of years, the civil leader tended to be the head of the state church, as it were. But in England, in Britain, that's still the same. The Queen is literally the formal head of the Anglican Church, which used to be the only church allowed in Britain, but they changed that. Anyway, these old ideas are not only not going away, but in trying to come back, they are disturbing the peace. Oh, yeah, there was a fourth empire I almost forgot. Iran, most people don't realize, has been an empire in that part of the world for thousands of years. I mean, what Alexander the Great conquered, you know, 2,500 years ago was an Iranian empire, or Persian, whatever you want to call it. But the same people, you know, using many different aliases. And the Persian Empire has been in decline, I'd say for about 1,000 years. You know, they make a little bit of resurgence, and they beaten back again. And they've never forgotten that. The Shah of Iran, who was overthrown in 1979 by basically a clerical-led revolution, made no secret. I mean, he held great big celebrations. People were seriously, I mean, there were articles in magazines and newspapers about the potential threat of Iranian imperial ambitions. I mean, most of us forget this now, but I was a young guy back then, and I remember reading about this. I thought to myself at the time, they got to be kidding. But as the years went by, I realized they weren't kidding. They are not kidding. And what is going on, has been going on in Iran for the last 30 years, is the religious leaders, they said, well, we basically gained control of Iran, but now we want to control all of Islam, which brings all sorts of complications, which I won't go into here, but we've been into it in strategy phase. It's basically the Shia-Sunni thing. But it's basically the Iranian empire, but this time with a religious leader at the head, not a warlord, as the Shah's father, the last Shah's father was, you know, or any other civil leader, but a religious leader. So all the majority of the problems we're having in the world today basically go back to countries that are trying to revive their empires. And it's not going to work. In fact, in many cases, these empires are trying to grab pieces of each other. For example, although China has been quiet about this, one of the lost imperial lands is most of the Russian Far East, Vladivostok, all those areas, you know, bordering the Pacific. China has long had claims on that. They never bothered to exercise them because there was nothing up there, but then they discovered oil. So, you know, China has become officially an ally of Russia, but the Russians are well aware of the fact that China has these ancient claims, and China is basically going down a large list of these old claims, as it were. And just because the Russian Far East isn't on it doesn't mean it's not in a secret appendix. And of course, the caliphate wants to conquer the world, which puts all other empires, you know, at risk. So this whole empire building routine is not only disturbing the peace, but it threatens to cause even more war if any of them go, you know, as far as they want to go, which none of them will. Again, because the reason most empires self-destructing in the 20th century, I mean, the 20th century has been described even before the end of the century as, you know, the graveyard of empires, because after World War One, you had the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, poof, all gone. After World War II, actually during World War II, this is a humorous, you know, insight into what happens to empires. Britain knew it was broke even during World War II, and so they were doing financial planning for post-war. This was, you know, 43, 44, whatever. And Churchill basically had a rigorous, you know, accounting, as it were, of what it was taking to run the government. And one of the things that came out of it, which appalled Churchill, because he thought somebody had done this before, it was that found out one of the biggest, you know, money pits was the empire, you know, especially India. I mean, they at one time, a century before, they were making profit, but that profit had long since gone away, and nobody wanted to make a stink about it. Who wants to give up an empire when it seems to be working? But that's why Britain rapidly dispensed of its imperial possessions right after, you know, World War II. And most other countries followed suit. You know, France needed a little, you know, push, but they eventually got rid of all their imperial possessions. The United States, even before World War II, had told the Philippines, you know, in 1945, you know, you're free. The Puerto Rico was supposed to be free, but they basically said, no, no, we'd like to, you know, stay part of the United States. All the other, you know, basically all the European empires were gone by the 1960s, 1970s at the latest for some of them. Imperialism has come back into favor, at least in some parts of the world. And it's still a problem.
Austin, your comments on what Jim has said?
Well, yeah, number of things. Let me pick up on, I'll expand on what Jim said about some things that we had done in a quick and dirty guide to war. If you look both at the first and second edition, and I'll concentrate on the second edition, which was published in 1992. We had discussions in both of them about imperial breakdown and I'll use this term, reassembly, Dan, elements of reassembly. And that's what Jim, when he says the Empire's Strike Back, playing off of the Star Wars movie title, which is, it's funny, except it's not funny when you see it being imposed aggressively with annexation and empire building, like what Putin's doing in Ukraine. But let me tell you why I go to the 92 edition. I think we mentioned this, either Jim or I did, maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago in one of our first discussions about Ukraine. Russia, if Moscow, let's say, we'll go czarist. Jim might like this even better. The Kremlin, if the Kremlin controls what is now the Russian state, Kazakhstan, with its natural resources and its location, where it goes, Ukraine, with its breadbasket and resources and population, and Belarus, our white Russia. And just as a sidebar on this, remember, during the Cold War, Belarus and Ukraine both had seats in the United Nations. Just remember that. That was so Russia, the Soviet Union had three votes, if you want, even though the Soviet Union itself was on permanent member of the Security Council. Ukraine and Belarus had delegations at the United Nations. See? So the Soviet Empire played a double game with that. But the 92 edition looked at, even though Jim and I were writing it in 91, and the official breakdown of the Soviet Union is not until December 31st, 1991. We looked at what might be, if somebody, and I didn't know who Vladimir Putin was, nor did Jim, but let's say a Russian neo-nationalist, neo-imperialist, sitting in Moscow with still retaining nuclear weapons and still being a Russian, Russian nationalist, says, if I'm going to be a superpower again, what do I need? Well, I need Kazakhstan. Well, I need Belarus. Oh, I need Ukraine. And R-U-B-K, and so playing off of Rubik's Cube, I called it the Rubik, because, you know, the Rubik's Cube was that little puzzle you'd move around and you try to match all the little sub-cubes in the puzzle. Well, that's a Russian empire. And that's what Jim means about the empire striking back and Putin pulling the shade has dropped. Ignore the man behind the curtain, except you can't ignore it now. The curtain of propaganda is still up to confuse some, but you see the move on Crimea and eastern Ukraine. And Jim pointed out South Ossetia, Abkhazia in Georgia. There's a slight difference with that. That in retrospect, the reading on, hey, that was a probe, that was presented as a lesson on the Kosovo precedent, because that's the same year that Kosovo unilaterally secedes from Serbia. And Kosovo's the Kosovo War, the Clinton administration said that was to stop ethnic cleansing, genocide in Kosovo. Evidence for that was going on, no question about it. But the way that the Kremlin, way Putin played Georgia, was that there were pro-Russian elements in South Ossetia and Abkhazia and a Georgian peacekeeping force moving in. And so the Kremlin said, we're coming in to protect those ethnic minorities. They have yet to annex South Ossetia and Abkhazia. They have annexed Crimea, and we're going to see what goes on with Ukraine. So the case study, the evidence for the expansion, is going on right now before us in Ukraine, and that is the reassembly of a Russian empire. Now, as for the caliphate, we've covered that on strategy page from the get-go. There are two columns of mine, Creator Syndicate columns that are up in the strategy page archive of the fall of 2001 after 9/11 that discuss this, including one in, I don't have the date in front of me, Dan, but it's in November of 2001 where it's basically a discussion of the war for the terms of modernity, and it talks about the reassembling of the caliphate as the motivating idea behind the militant Islamists, with al-Qaeda being one, the extreme example of that group. And part of the cue given to the world on that, not only you see that when you read a material from al-Qaeda propaganda and the like, of even in the 1990s, but in October of 2001, Bin Laden releases one of his videotapes. I think this was on a videotape. There was where I saw it on the first of the internet was just audio. But what he talks about is 80 years of suffering by the Muslims in the world, and really what he's pointing at is the end of the caliphate, which Kemal Ataturk, you know, I've got that bio on Ataturk, and I cover that in that biography of Ataturk, ends, even though it had been moribund and been really run as a political institution by the Ottoman Empire. It ends in 1924, and that's what he's talking about. He says that's the deep wound. We're going to rebuild it, and then this will be, as Jim calls it, the Islamic Empire. Now, on China, you know, China's actually, there's a terrible struggle going on in China, and sometimes the struggle is going on in individuals. They haven't resolved it. They see the power of the global economy and how China can succeed in that, and that requires cooperation on requires salespeople, requires advertising, requires rule of law, and they can see how. But you can get rich doing that, and they've made a lot of money in that area. At the same time, as Jim says, human nature here. They look around and they say, well, this entire East Asia was under our control, and we're the rightful, to use their word, hegemonists, and you see that being played out with certainly economic and resource components in the South China Sea. The argument was made really in the 1950s by very astute Chinese experts that Mao's grab of Tibet was an imperial grab by a communist, a so-called global communist, but he was going to grab Tibet because Chinese control of Tibet, as far as the emperor was concerned, was essential. Grab the high ground. Well, I'm being a bit simplistic about it, but communists were going to bring peace to the world, and they weren't imperialists. And the first thing Mao does after he's kicked Chiang Kai-shek off the mainland is take Tibet. Jim talked about the Chinese coveting Russian eastern lands, Vladivostok and the like. Well, they've sparred over that region, the Chinese communists and Soviet Union in the late 1960s along the Amur River line. But the Chinese say this was stolen from us by the Russian imperialists. And it certainly is a natural resources, a treasure trove. There's a column on called China's Boisterous Borders that I remember you did something with, but when I wrote, I think it was in 2001 as well, that actually touches on that. And then when Jim brings up Iran, look, one of the things that motivated the Ayatollah Khomeini, here he's talking a revival of another Islamic empire and the like, but that his his center group of Iranian Islamic revolutionaries were Iran really had a sense of Iranian dominance, and that is connected to we are the center of the of the world thinking that grows out of the 5th century BC in Iran. We're also unique. We have a we once dominated the Middle East, and they did. We dominated the Mesopotamia, and they did. And that's never quite those aspirations, that notion of a historical golden age that could be recovered has never left Iranian aspirations. Let's say that there's always an appeal to that, and that's part of what Jim's talking about. You see that in the way the current Iranian dictatorship behaves. Iran is in some ways a mini empire. Because they're Persians, Aryans, Iran is Aryanistan, make up maybe between 50 and 60% of the population on a good day. You look around and they've got certain kinds of, you know, cousins, Azeris, but then they've also got Kurds, and then they've got a number of Baluchis in eastern Iran that just as soon would be part of a free Baluchistan. And there's even a radical Islamist Baluchi movement in eastern Iran that the radical, and of course, they're Shia versus Sunni here, but the radical Iranian Islamists are fighting tooth and nail. That doesn't get a lot of coverage. We mention on Strategy Page every once in a while. But Iran is a mini empire. You could also argue that Ethiopia is as well, but Ethiopia has lost, been losing parts of its empire since the 18th century. But it's still aspects of an Ethiopian empire, and that's an old empire. That dates back to the 8th century BC, doesn't it, Jim?
Yeah.
Yep, there you are. I just mentioned that word. Yeah, very old school on this. I would toss out, too, that they're aspirational empires, Dan. Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, for a while toyed with what was labeled a neo-Ottoman foreign policy, Turkey reasserting itself in its former Arab provinces. You see out of Brazil every once in a while a notion of a Portuguese trading trading organization uniting old Portuguese colonies, and the Brazilians, they talk about Angola and the like. Angola's got oil in Brazil. That's and then Indonesia was the Indonesian after the collapse of the Dutch in the East Indies after World War II. The Javanese said, we're just going to rebuild the Dutch East Indies, and went about conquering all the other islands, even and took the western half of New Guinea, which had nothing to do with the Javanese and the predominantly Muslim East Indies. They just went and took it. They also took East Timor, which they've had to cough up. But that was an imperial action by when to look at the core group coming out of that by the Javanese. How stable that is another question. Anyway, Jim, I thought I'd mention that, because that certainly is another example of what you mean about human nature here.
Now, Jim, one of the interesting things about the Islamic caliphate trying to reassert itself is who gets to be the caliphate, right?
Well, that's what tore it apart in the first place. Khalifa is an Arab word meaning succession. And it was basically a battle. In fact, that's what mainly divides Shia and Sunni, an ancient dispute over what are the criteria for determining who will be the next caliph. So that what you just asked for, it goes right to the heart of the problem with maintaining the caliphate. Since the 10th century, there have been many caliphs, but basically they were simply the largest Islamic empire, you know, Muslim empire around. The head of that would say, I'm the caliph, anybody want to dispute me? The last one was the Turks. The Turks have been the caliph for several centuries, the Turkish, you know, sultan. And when the Turkish Empire fell after World War I, the caliphate, you know, was in effect gone, and it was formally, I think it was formally renounced by the Turks sometime in the 1920s. So nobody has really come along and tried to pick it up. Even the Saudis, who are the guardians of the holy places in Saudi Arabia, they have been reluctant to, you know, touch that. It's sort of a poison prize. You know, you look at history and you find out whoever declares that the caliphate is just, you know, well, be careful what you ask for. You might get it. And if you get the caliphate, you're in big trouble. So all of these imperial ambitions are basically suicidal. Any of the people who are now, I mean, the Chinese are doing it because it basically helps keep the Communist Party in power. I mean, China is still basically a communist dictatorship. So, you know, bringing up these imperial ambitions, it's very popular out of Chinese. I mean, China, non-Chinese don't appreciate it. But China has been down for so long, you know, anything they can do is a big move upward, you know, the growing economy and what have you. But for two centuries, China was just one disaster after another. Now, the Chinese are well aware of that. The rest of the world, not so much. They say, hey, there's a lot of Chinese. They must be doing something right, you know. But, you know, China is more than a lot of sex. They want to be able to run their own country, and they also want to be able to run the neighbors as well as a form of, you know, insurance against, you know, more invasion and what have you. Russians, the same deal. The reason the Russian Empire grew was because they needed space to protect them from the next invasion. The Russians, in many respects, never got over the invasion of the Mongols. And the Mongols basically controlled most of Russia for several centuries. And they were not gentle rulers. And the Russians are still in fear of this. And then, of course, the even before the Mongols showed up, the Russians were getting hammered by the Germans, the Dragunov Ostin, which, you know, peaked, as it were, in 1941 when Germany invaded Russia big time with the Soviet Union. The French even had a go at it in 1812. So you can see the Russians have this paranoia about defense, and they don't really believe that nuclear weapons alone will defend them. For example, they notice that the Chinese are big fans of the grab and negotiate tactic. In other words, China and Russia both have nuclear weapons, so neither can afford to get into a long war because that might escalate into a nuclear exchange, in which case everybody loses. But what the Chinese have figured out, as others have figured out before them, is that under those conditions, you can basically just, you know, gather your forces and jump and grab a chunk of territory and then stop and say, all right, let's make peace. Except everybody's got to keep what they got, and we've got part of you. You know, and this basically takes the wind out of the payback, as it were, the country that you stole the land from. They say, well, do we want to have a nuclear risk, a nuclear war, just to get Vladivostok back? You know, Russia fears that. Actually, not just Russia, but all of China's neighbors fear that. Well, they should, because, you know, it's basically a good tactic, and it'll probably work, you know, for China if they try it. But the Chinese have something beyond nuclear weapons to worry about. They are, for the first time in their history, a major exporting nation. Until very recently, China was very proud of the fact that they were self-contained. They were what the academics call a continental power. They weren't a oceanic power. They trades a lot. And now they basically depend on trade, not just to sell their manufactured goods, but to import essential raw materials. And as long as that exists, they really can't afford a war, because what it will do is escalate into a trade war. And that's exactly what the United States has been doing recently. Again, that doesn't get a lot of publicity, but all of China's neighbors, who are, most of them are allies of the United States, or at least friendly towards us, They have been calling at us, say, to do something. So what we basically said, they say, look, we put sanctions on Iran. We're putting more sanctions on Russia. We can put sanctions on you. Now, the trouble with Russia is that unlike, well, Iran was hurting badly because they had half of their oil exports cut off last year. But Russia is fairly immune, you know, to economic sanctions. China is very vulnerable. And so the Chinese are concerned about that. So this empire building is not as risk-free as it looks. And what you have to worry about is that when the empire building, you know, gets out of hand, as it were, and the victims start to, you know, basically fight back, things can spiral out of control very quickly. I mean, that's basically what happened with World War One. The World War One, some people point out, is not really over. You know, that led to World War II, that led to the Cold War. The Cold War is over, but now we got, you know, the Cold War being revived under the guise of reconstituting empires. Be careful what you ask for. If you get it, you might be screwed.
Yeah. Austin, one of the interesting things that I'll let you wrap this all up with is that here in the United States, you know, if you went and talked to most people and you said, well, you know, the United States is an empire, they would have a negative reaction to it, unless you're talking to Noam Chomsky or something, and you know, he's going to agree with you. But in these other countries, you don't see that negative reaction, right, Austin, as much as you would here in the United States.
Well, look, a question about look, the accusation of the United States is an empire really repeats, regurgitates 70 years of communist propaganda, and that there's the question of U.S. Imperial aspirations. Look, the United States moved out of Subic Bay in the Philippines. I'm just going to give you I could give you several hundred examples of this. The United States leaves. Now the Filipinos kind of sorta. More and more want the U.S. Navy back on at least a semi-permanent, if not permanent, basis, because they know the Chinese, when they take something, they intend to annex it. You see that going on throughout the rest of Southeast Asia, with the possible exception of Cambodia, which is developed a very close relations with China, and there's, as Jim has pointed out, there's also some economic considerations with that. Part of what comes with the U.S., and I will put Great Britain in this, you hear the term Anglosphere, and really it's more of a connection to linguistic connector, as well as a rule of law connector. Some of it growing out of the impact, of the positive impacts of the British Empire. And one of the positive impacts was open trade. Not quite free trade. That's part of what's been spun off the American Revolution. But Britain, in its own interest, the Royal Navy puts down piracy. But that makes it much easier for the rest of the world to begin to trade long distance trade. If it sounds like that there's an influence of Adam Smith and Wealth of Nations behind this, well, Dan, there is. And remember, a few moments ago, I told you that China's, and Jim mentioned this too, China, he says China's vulnerable now to economic sanctions. The Chinese have seen that this global economic system, which the U.S. kind of dominates, we don't dominate it totally, despite what you may see in the propaganda, China plays a large role in it. Germany and European Union does as well. Japan does. It is, to pinch a damage term, the global system is a type of true co-prosperity sphere, because if you cooperate with it, and part of it has to do with honoring contracts. Let's get back to rule of law here, Dan. Hey, there's a way for everybody to improve their own economic situation. But as Jim said when he led off on this in this strategy talk, and then I came back and I said, you know, you'll find individual Chinese that are torn corn bodies. There's this component back there of saying, you know, we were great once. Gee, when we were in control, we just don't get the respect that we deserve. And that's the connecting point when Jim says, you know, some of this plays so well in domestic politics. You certainly see Putin doing that here in Russia right now. I argue that what you see out of this is there's a kind of response to this successful globalism, economic globalism. That's part of what this Empire Strike Back business is about. And I haven't heard anybody, you know, outside of us on the strategy page make that argument. But as Jim points out, Russia, to a degree, at least at the natural resources level, is largely immune to some of these economic sanctions. It still costs them. Because they're you know who Russia's biggest trading partner is? It's Germany, as far as I understand it. But the thing is mostly with the EU. The Russians, for their neo-imperialism, are going to pay an economic price. They may get a cultural, psychological boost out of it, saying, you know, we're back on top, we've come back, or whatever. You know, we're showing we're tough. This is what Jim says about the price for this kind of action. Nevertheless, take a look. It's affecting Russia. It's affecting China. It's affecting Iran. How do you deal with the? One of the biggest problems still is how you deal with this restore the caliphate imperial dream that propels these Muslim militants. There are numerous things you'll see on the strategy page, and Jim writes about this a lot. You have all these poor, unemployed, young Muslim men that live in these authoritarian states. They have no place to go and nothing to do, and they're galvanized by this, well, gee, yeah, if we just get this right, then God will bless us and we'll be powerful again. And, of course, they're being ripped off by their own crooked establishments. There's an element of corruption, real corruption, that runs through this kind of aggressive neo-imperialism. It's not to say that the United States and Australia and Canada and Great Britain and India's got real corruption problems, but they also, there's a balancing act that goes on, and I'm tossed India in, put in Singapore. To some degree, Kenya has corruption issues, but when you compare what else goes on in the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, suddenly you see Kenya and South Africa as big upsides. There's a experience with rule of law, honoring contract.
So I guess one of the things we could say is that the wrap this all up is the we'll have a return of the rule of the law after the Empire Strikes Back.
We could.
Well, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
All right, take care, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.